Good morning. How many of you have ever been on a vacation? I hope everybody gets to experience a couple in life. And whether it's getting ready to go on a vacation, or maybe you're a snowbird and you get to travel down for the season, there's that night before the trip where, for me, it's probably the first time I've even allowed myself to think about the trip that we're going on, because I generally am juggling quite a few things. But the night before, everything begins to feel real. And from my childhood into adulthood now, there's something exciting about getting ready and knowing. There's that little bit of nervousness, especially for me as an adult, knowing that we have lots of pegs to pack in the vehicle and that Tetris game will await me in the morning. There's some nervousness. There's some excitement. There's this sense that something good is happening. Well, that's not unlike what the nation of Israel felt as they're going into Passover and this final plague that God will do. We're going to jump forward a chapter. Next week, we're going to look at chapter 11. But I wanted to focus on chapter 12 today. In chapter 11, we're going to get to see the fallout, and we're going to get to see the pain of the plague to come. The final nail in Egypt's coffin. The final plague that will allow Pharaoh and all of Egypt to send Israel away. The moment in which God delivers them from their bondage of slavery. But before that, God is saying to his people, it's time to have a feast the night before. And it's no ordinary feast. It's one that will be celebrated moving forward year after year after year. We do some feasting in our Western culture. I mean, Thanksgiving's probably the best example. Many of you try and do a feast around Christmas. I know there are family meals Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. But Thanksgiving's the big one, where many of us cook a turkey and all of the different sides and fixings, and it's important. And what do we do on Thanksgiving? We remember and we commemorate what we're thankful for. Feasting for the Jewish people wasn't all that different, but there was a greater emphasis on the commemorating and remembering. These were instrumental pieces throughout the year to reorient God's people towards him, to give them an upward look and to help them remember what God had done long ago, but also what God was doing for them here and now and what God would do for them in the future. That God was faithful yesterday, that he's faithful today, and he will be faithful always. And so we see God giving some instructions that without context might be a little confusing for us. What is God doing? Why does he want bread made without yeast? Why does he want the meat to be roasted and not boiled? Why is God requiring these things? And I think as we narrow in on that, as we focus on what God is doing through the Feast of Passover, that first Passover celebration, and then the remembrance of thereafter, we get to understand a lot about what God is doing, what God is doing in the nation of Israel to bring them together. Remember that their identity had been shattered in many ways if they had years of slavery, of hard work, of persecution. And now God is saying, today, this is the eve of when I deliver you, when I make good on all my promises, when I set you free and establish you again as a nation of my people. So the first thing I want to draw our attention to is how the Passover feast defined the nation of Israel. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor. Having taken into account the number of people there are, you are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. First thing that I think we need to understand is that this feast was for the entire nation of Israel. This was for all of them. And as we go forward a little bit, Moses in Exodus gives some instructions from God that I think are fascinating. You see, what it meant to be a Hebrew had been sort of loosened over these years. And so you had those that were slaves, but some of the slaves had servants, and those who were God-fearers but didn't consider themselves necessarily part of the original lineage. And what God said was, he said, anyone in your family that fears me, in your household that fears me, is welcome at the Passover as long as they go under the knife of circumcision. So you didn't exactly have to be one of the descendants of Jacob. If you were part of the household, if you were one of the servants, if you were someone who worked and served in the household of the Jewish families, then you were welcome to become part of this nation. It's one of the early first times we see branches being grafted into this tree, this image that Paul gives us in the New Testament. You can ask me, am I Jewish? I don't really look Jewish. If you took my DNA test, you're not going to find that I have a lot of Jewish heritage, but I am grafted in as a branch into that tree because I have gone through the circumcision of the heart in Jesus. So this is an early example where God is showing that he is willing to bring people into his kingdom, that he's willing to bring people into his nation and graft them in. But they had to be willing to go under the knife of circumcision. We wonder, as we look in the New Testament, we get confused why there's so much infighting about this idea when the Gentiles come into the church, do they need to be circumcised or not circumcised? But historically, for the Jewish people, this was kind of the big sign. You can say that you believe, but sometimes actions speak louder than words. And it was a symbol for thousands of years that you were part of God's family, his tribe, his nation. So again, this was for everybody. Everyone, and God is taking this group of slaves, this group of oppressed people, and now he's bringing them together, and he's restoring this national identity. He's helping them to understand that they are his people, that they are a community together. Remember when Moses goes and defends his brother from the Egyptian and he ends up striking down the Egyptian oppressor dead, the one who is abusing the Hebrew slave. You would think that there might be some camaraderie. This man helped us, but there wasn't so much of an us. It was a lot of angry, grumpy people. I've seen this happen in the church too, when a church splits. And you have all of this tension and all of this anger, and a big group leaves unhappy. But what you find out when they try and start their new church, when they meet across town or across the street or wherever it may be, that the one thing that unified that group was their hatred or frustration with what was happening. But when it came time for them to put together a new community, there was nothing left to unite them. And they all begin to bicker and infight. And that's a real risk for the nation of Israel here. So God is using this feast as the first of many opportunities to gather this nation together and to give them a new identity that reflects the Father. So everyone, as long as they go through the rite of circumcision, the entire nation participated. But then we also see that God commanded them to be careful not to over-prepare, over-consume, or leave anyone out. So God says, if your neighbor's family is too small for their own land, then you as the head of the household, you need to invite them in. It's not about your table being full and everyone having way more than enough. No, this was about you looking around your left and your right to see, is there a widow? Is there an orphan? Is there someone by themselves? Is there a young person just starting out? How do we bring them in and invite them into our household, our family? Because that's what this new nation is. We're not a collection of strangers, but we look out for one another, and we're doing this together. God is saying, you are your brother's keeper to these Hebrew slaves becoming the nation of Israel. God speaks to his people through the idea of communion. We take communion with a little cup of juice and a little bit of bread, and this is one of the reasons that I want to do breakfast on Communion Sunday. Because in the early church, it wasn't a cup of juice and a little bite of bread. It was a meal together. They were eating. They called it a feast of love together for the church. But there were things that begin to creep in where they had wealthy and influential members of the church that were coming, and they were bringing lots of food, but they were leaving full, and they were acting in ways that may have been gluttonous. They were over-consuming. When at the same feast, at the same communion, there were those who had very little to bring that were leaving hungry. The Apostle Paul addresses, he said, this should not be. This is about us all coming together. And maybe outside of the church, you have more stuff than they do. But here together, we share and we partake and we are all God's children together. Doesn't love one more than the other. And that's the picture that we're getting here in this first Passover feast. There's also a picture of what's to come, and this idea of reliance and dependence upon God. If you were packing for a journey, and again, we're spoiled, we can hit the road in the middle of the night, and I know there's probably going to be a speedway open. If I need a bottle of water, I can go and stop and get a bottle of water or some beef jerky or some peanuts, whatever I need to sustain myself and move down the road. But it wasn't the case with the Egyptian people going, or the Hebrew people going out into the desert. There was no 7-Eleven, there was no Myers, no Walmart, no Speedway. And God here is saying, don't pack a bag of food. Don't bring the leftovers. Wouldn't that be tempting? You have this big feast. What do we do on Thanksgiving? We eat turkey for like a week, right? We have all this extra food. And there would be a temptation, I think even maybe a natural logical response to say, all right, let's get a little bit of extra. Let's pack it with us. And we've got some snacks for the journey. We have some food to sustain us. But just like God did with manna and will be doing for the people of Israel as they go through the desert, he's saying, take just enough for today because this is a battle I'm fighting for you. It's already won. You don't have to worry about what you will eat or what will be there for you because every step of the way, I will provide. And what does he do? He brings manna, bread from heaven, their daily bread, and they are able to rely on him. But God says, don't get enough for tomorrow. If they did, it would turn to maggots in the jar or the clay vessel. It would be gross and disgusting. He said, no, trust me that just as I provided for you today, I will provide for you tomorrow. This was a learning to walk in faith daily, step by step. Sometimes I struggle with this. God, I want a 5-year plan. I want to know exactly what you're doing. And God says, walk to the end of the light I've given you. We're in a dark room and we have a flashlight and I can see the next 3 steps. And that's all I need because if you're holding a flashlight and you take 3 steps, after you take 3 steps, you can see 3 more steps. So God has given them instructions to move. And he's saying, if I am powerful enough to deliver you from the hands of the most powerful king on earth, the Pharaoh, and the most powerful nation on earth at the time, Egypt, if I will have them, if you are going to be able to walk out of here today, why can't you trust that I will feed you tomorrow? It's even bigger than that. Because as we go back one chapter in chapter 11, we see that God does this thing that's fascinating. Before, as part of the preparation for Passover, he sends the Hebrew people out to their Egyptian neighbors, and he predisposes the Egyptian neighbor to be very generous. So they walk and they're greeted again. This is 9 plagues, some of them obnoxious that they shared in together, but now the really painful ones, the really scary ones. Those have been for Egypt only. The Hebrew people have been spared. And the Egyptians, they're afraid and they're frustrated. But even in all of that, God touches their heart for them to be generous. And as the Hebrew people come and approach the Egyptian slavers, really, those who had been their oppressors, the Egyptians were giving them jewelry and gold. God says this was a payment for all of the work that they had done. Now, that doesn't happen naturally. It's a supernatural thing that God had done, but he's showing them again, if I can change the heart of the Egyptian person who legitimately hates you right now, so that they give you their jewels and their gold and they're generous with you in a way that doesn't even make sense, I can give you food in the desert. I will meet your needs tomorrow the way I've met your needs today. So again, the Passover feast, it began to define and pull together the nation of Israel. And God makes it clear that this day would be remembered, would be commemorated, would be celebrated deep into the future. The second thing that I think we cannot miss out on understanding is that the Passover feast required a spotless lamb. Verse 5, the animal you choose must be year-old males without defect. You may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month. Then all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. In the land of Goshen, in the village of the Hebrew people, all the men of the household walked out together on this night at twilight to sacrifice, to kill this lamb that would be their Passover meal. But again, this meal looks a lot more like a sacrifice than a meal. This isn't going and picking up food for dinner. God was very specific. Couldn't be the weakling. Couldn't be the little one. This was the best one. And as we understand the sacrificial system moving forward, and as we look way forward to the person and the death of Jesus on the cross, we see that that is what God is showing and instituting in this Passover meal. This lamb is a sacrifice. It's a placeholder for what Jesus will do for them on the cross, for the sacrifices that will happen in the tabernacle. This is the spotless lamb that Isaac asked his father about when they climbed Mount Moriah. When Abraham may have thought Isaac was the sacrifice. It's the spotless lamb that God provided tied up in the thorns and the brambles on top of Mount Moriah when Abraham was tested to see if he would not withhold his one and only beloved son. This is one piece in a very big story, where we have to understand that there is no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. And for Abraham on Mount Moriah, God provided the lamb. And here, God had provided, and at twilight, all the men of Israel would slaughter this lamb for the feast, where not a bit was to be left behind. and it was to be shared together. And in the tabernacle in the desert, they would make sacrifice for their sins to be forgiven. And all of that, again, looked forward to Jesus, the true spotless Lamb, the true sinless one, sent from God as a gift to us, who bore all our sin. All of those other sacrifices looked forward to that day, to that moment on the cross, where it was finished. Again, this isn't an ordinary meal. This is God showing a sacrifice. There's a paradoxical tension. If you bear with me for a minute. It's easy for God to say that He forgives our sins. Those words, they're easy for us to hear, they're easy for us to say, but they're harder for us to believe. Now, they may be easy things to say, they may be easy things to portray, but it was a very difficult thing that God did. And we see this in Jesus when He heals the paralytic man. He doesn't begin by healing him. He's in the temple and He begins by forgiving the man's sins. And the Pharisees are like, whoa, 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 whoa. You can't forgive his sins. And Jesus says something powerful. He says, so that you may believe that I have the power to forgive his sins, so that I may do the former, now I tell him to get up and walk. For God, the ability to perform a miraculous sign, to simply tell the man to get up and walk, that was easy. But for us, it proved that God could do the harder thing. Forgiving the sins of the world is far more profound and had far more of a consequence, especially on the person of Jesus Christ. It was the only time we saw Jesus in the garden saying, Lord, if this cup could pass me by, if there is any other way. He was so perplexed that he was sweating blood. His humanity was breaking under the strain of what he had to do, what he chose to do for us. But yet, so that he could prove that he had the ability to do that, he did a miracle. He said, get up and walk. Here, God has done 9 and is about to do the 10th miraculous sign. Actually, more miracles, because not all of them were the plagues. We started with some simple ones. But God is doing over and over these miraculous signs to show Egypt, but really to show his nation of Israel that he is capable of delivering them. Make no mistake that all of this was about showing that God was capable of delivering his people. But he delivered them from the human hand of Pharaoh to prove, just like Jesus telling the paralytic man to walk, that he had the power to forgive their sins. So this earthly sacrifice, it's a way to remember and consecrate the moment. But God, he's had the power to forgive sins all along, looking forward to the moment Jesus would take the cross. Time is different for God than it is for us. See, even at this moment in history, I believe that in God's heart and mind, because he is above and beyond time, the cross had already happened. We were just waiting for it to play out in our linear dimension. God is limitless. We are limited. But again, there's that tension. And it's strange that the small thing is what proves to us that the big and profound thing is real. And the same thing was true here for the nation of Israel. And then finally, the Passover feast prepared Israel to move. Verse 10, do not leave it any of it, and he's talking about the Passover meal, till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you were to eat it. With your cloak tucked into your belt, with your sandals on your feet, with your staff in your hand. This may be the first fast food we ever see. Eat it in haste. This is the Lord's Passover. I don't think we can move forward without addressing those final words. This is the Lord's Passover. It's not Moses' Passover. It's not Pharaoh's Passover. It's not even the Hebrew people's Passover. What does God say? It is the Lord's Passover. I've heard Christians say, well, why should I care about Passover at all? That's an Old Testament Jewish thing. So, well, God doesn't call it a Jewish Passover. He calls it His Passover. This is something that He is doing. Again, we are fighting a battle that God has already won. And God isn't punishing His people here when He commands them to have no leftovers. He's delivering them. And He wants them to be ready to move. Tomorrow's a big day. You've got a lot to do. Because God is calling them to bring the herds with Him, to bring all of their wealth. This is moving day. You're leaving Egypt. And again, every other plague, Pharaoh said the same thing. No, I'm not doing that. I'm not allowing that. But he's telling his people, tomorrow's the day. Trust me, you're leaving. It's easy to look around, get a little envious and jealous of what our neighbors have. But on this eve of the most horrific event in Egyptian history, when even Pharaoh himself will lose his firstborn son, where the angel of death will come through every home in Egypt and cause devastation. I can't imagine why the Jewish people would be envious of any of the beautiful homes in Egypt. Even Pharaoh's palace is not a place I would want to be that day. And I think we get caught up. We see other people's homes, other people's cars, other people's pretty baubles and trinkets. We think, I want some of those. Those seem nice. Why does God give them those and not to me? Well, maybe God is preparing you to move. I'm not saying move houses, but maybe he's calling you into something where you must leave those things behind. Because a beautiful house does nothing for us if it's in the wrong place. And God has said, we are not children of this world, that this is not our home, but we are aliens, we are strangers, we are immigrants, and our home is heaven. So I believe that we must have the same mindset. They celebrated Passover every year to remind them that at any moment, God could call them into something good and amazing. He could deliver them, but it required them to leave it behind and go. When I do counseling, I get frustrated. I don't do a ton of counseling, but I do some. When you see that God is ready to deliver someone, but they're hanging on so tightly to the things that God wants to deliver them from. We hang on to our stuff. We envy those things around us. But here, God was clear, and it wasn't because he didn't want to give his people abundance. He had abundance in mind. He was taking them to the chosen land, to the land of giants of milk and honey. He had good things for them. God was not trying to oppress them. He was delivering them. He wasn't trying to withhold his goodness from them. He was about to pour it out. but it required them to tuck their cloak in their belt, to leave their food behind, and to go. And I wonder for myself, I wonder for us, how many times we miss out on the powerful abundance of God, on His ability to deliver us because we're too content. We're too content trying to pack all these things around us. God was preparing His people to move. It's been a weird couple years. You all know that for Beth and I. It's got to the place where I think we both pretty much always have a go bag packed. Because we don't know when we're going to have to go to the hospital or we're going to have to take care of something. And it's a lot more convenient to grab a bag ready to go than it is to pack one. But even in the midst of that, if I were to tell my kids tomorrow, hey kids, pack a bag, we're leaving, we're going on an adventure, but trust me, it'll be good. My kids would be excited. Because we've done things like this before, and we went down to Disney World. We've done things like this before, and it ended up we went to a city, and we hung out at the Marriott, and we ate good food, and we had a great time. My kids know, and they trust, that when I say, hey, tomorrow morning we're going to go, and I can't tell you what it is, that I'm not going to take them to go live in a car or under a bridge. And again, if anyone's been there, I'm not judging that. But they trust me because I'm their father and I have a history of giving them good gifts. Well, God is a much better father than I am. And when God says, trust me, it's time to go, I have plans for you. Why? Why do we stop and say, oh no, God, I'm not so sure about that. But God, why would you ask me to leave all this behind? God, why haven't you given me what you gave Bill over there? Why isn't my house as pretty? Why isn't my car as nice? No. God's never failed you. He's always provided for you. And just like the nation of Israel, we have to be reminded continually. It's one of the reasons we feast and we celebrate even Thanksgiving. I hope that we can get back to this idea of remembering what God has done. Because it's by remembering God's faithfulness that we're able to step out again today, tomorrow, when He calls us to leave all of this stuff behind and follow Him.